Thanks for tuning in to the October 20th podcast. I'm Jeff Ratliff, deputy editor of the podcast. This week's featured interview features a discussion on new-onset super-refractory status epilepticus. For our other segment, you'll hear a discussion on a New York Times article on neurologic sequela in sledding athletes. Hi, I'm Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University with the Neurology Podcast. Welcome to this week's featured article interview. This week, I'm joined by Elizabeth Matthews from Columbia University. Today, we're going to discuss her team's paper in the October 20, 2020 issue of Neurology titled New Onset Super Refractory Status Epilepticus, a Series of 26 Patients. Before we start, I did want to mention that much of the preparation for this interview and drafting of these questions was done by one of our excellent podcast interviewers and contributors, Hallie Alexander. Hallie's taken some well-deserved time for maternity leave, and we do wish her the best. In the meantime, I am stepping in, and as an admitted non-epilepsy expert, I'm excited to learn more about this topic along with everyone else. So without any further ado, Elizabeth, thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk more about our study.
So I suspect our listeners are familiar with these entities when it comes to new onset status epilepticus, but to settle on some terminology, can you help us define new onset refractory status epilepticus, or NORS, as well as the super refractory subcategory that you guys studied?
Sure. So new onset refractory status epilepticus refers to patients who have no neurologic history. They don't have a history of seizures. They have no clear trigger, and they go into very difficult to control or refractory status epilepticus. The super refractory subtype that we talked about here basically just refers to the more severe form of it, where in addition to treating these patients with anti-seizure, anti-epileptic medications, you have to then add additional continuous infusions of medications because they are so difficult to control. So the super refractory subtype is basically the more severe form of NORS, which in and of itself is a fairly severe condition.
And so now that we have those definitions clarified, can you tell us a little bit about why is studying these two entities so important?
Yeah, so these patients come in, many of them don't have a significant history. Many of them are young and healthy, and they come in with this incredibly severe presentation. They end up in our intensive care units for days, sometimes weeks or months, and the outcomes are variable. And that's one of the things we wanted to look at here, you know, depending on how severe their case is, what can you expect for how they're going to do? I think historically the thought was if somebody comes in with refractory status epilepticus, if you can't break their seizures quickly, they're not going to do well. I think that was the historical understanding of this condition. And we've seen before our study and then in our study that these patients really can recover and do well, but they require very intensive treatment. And beyond that, I think this is a heterogeneous patient population. They have many different etiologies. Many of them, we don't actually know the cause of their NORS. And so understanding the condition better will allow us to treat it better, both with anti-seizure medications, but then targeted treatments at the actual cause.
And so you alluded to the study and kind of did my segue for me, which is great. But my understanding that this is a retrospective study looking at patients meeting criteria for new onset super refractory status epilepticus. So what did you and your colleagues learn about this entity, and what are the ramifications for clinical care?
So yes, retrospectively, we looked at patients who met these criteria, and there were 26 patients who we studied, which is a fairly small number, but actually in this very rare condition, it's a fairly large single center series that we have. And we saw a few things. So we saw some confirmation of things that have been hinted at in smaller case series before. For example, we saw that many of our patients were cryptogenic. You know, we sent off many, many tests, infectious, autoimmune, inflammatory, malignant, and it all came back negative. So that was the largest percentage of our patient population. And even compared to other studies of NORS itself, in the super refractory group, they're more likely to be cryptogenic. So the cases that we know what's causing them are more likely to be treatable. And this confirms some smaller studies before that had, like I said, hinted at that fact. But I think it was helpful to see it reinforced in our study. A few other things we thought were important takeaways are that despite, like I mentioned earlier, you know, this is a very severe condition. People are in the ICU for weeks, months. Despite that, many of them can actually do well, both at discharge and if you follow them long term, even patients who don't have a phenomenal recovery at discharge can actually improve to a really good functional place long term. And so I think that was another important reason why we started this study, was to understand, you know, how far should we push these patients? How aggressively should we treat them when we're having a hard time controlling their seizures for so long?
So you mentioned that a lot of the patients in this study still had a cryptogenic etiology for their status epilepticus. So considering that many cases of NORS are of unclear etiology, like you said, I would imagine that this makes treatment difficult. So what did you all learn about how to recognize or diagnose potentially treatable causes among these patients?
Yeah, I think a big takeaway from our study, like I said, was that many of these patients were still undiagnosed. So even with all the tests that we have and all the knowledge we have of this condition, you know, many of them still end up undiagnosed. One thing that I think was an important takeaway from our study is we had seven patients or seven samples of neuropathology in our study. So patients who either went for brain biopsy or had neuropathology on autopsy. And three of these were actually diagnostic, which is, I think, unexpected in that a lot of former smaller studies have shown really nonspecific findings on the pathology. And in these three cases, one of them ended up having herpes simplex encephalitis, one of them had a fungal encephalitis, and one of them had ADEM, or acute demyelinating encephalomyelitis, which was thought to be triggered by a prior infection. And so the takeaway for this for us was for patients who you think might have an infection, so they have something that points toward a particular condition. So one of these cases, for example, had MRI findings that were very suspicious for herpes simplex encephalitis. And even though the spinal fluid was negative a couple of times, we had a high suspicion. Another case, the fungal encephalitis case, was a patient who came in appearing acutely to become very immunosuppressed. He had pancytopenia, and so the suspicion for something infectious was also higher in that case. And the third case was a patient who actually had exposure to a tick bite before this symptom started. And so, again, suspicion that this was either an acute infection or a post-infectious process. In cases like that, where you have a high suspicion for infection, but your initial tests like spinal taps aren't revealing anything, I think we should really consider having a low threshold to go to a brain biopsy. You know, it is a very quote-unquote invasive procedure, but we do them very frequently. They're generally very well tolerated. And especially if you have an area on the MRI that suggests, you know, a particularly inflammatory region with enhancement or a lot of swelling in that location suggests that might be a good spot for you to actually get some diagnosis. And so our thinking and our practice now looking at these patients is if somebody comes in and, you know, they have a classic story for NMDA encephalitis, which now is, you know, a very well-described condition, we wouldn't consider doing a brain biopsy. But if somebody comes in and they've had some sort of exposure or the imaging is suspicious and they're not getting better quickly with anti-seizure medications before jumping to something like immunotherapy, which we do in some of these patients, I think considering brain biopsy is important.
To build on that a little bit, you found that about one in five patients, or I think it was 19% in the study, did have an autoimmune etiology to their NORS. When might you give immunotherapy to these patients? Do you implement that only if you've discovered a confirmed antibody, or do we need to broaden this and maybe consider empiric immunotherapy even in the absence of a positive autoimmune antibody or other test?
So I think the direction we're moving in and what a lot of people who study this particular condition have suggested is we should really think about immunotherapy early. Certainly, you don't want to wait for the antibodies to come back because that can take a long time. And the earlier you started, the more likely you are to prevent permanent damage and to control the seizures. And so what our practice is if somebody comes in with a classic presentation for NMDA encephalitis, a young woman who develops psychiatric symptoms and then sort of progresses into encephalopathy and seizures, that's a patient who, if you get an initial spinal tap, there's no clear infection on it. Imaging doesn't show some big abnormality like an abscess or anything to make you think of an infection. We would go ahead and start them on immunotherapy even before confirming NMDA if they have sort of the classic clinical presentation. For the other cases where we don't have quite as well described of a phenotype of a patient, so other autoimmune encephalitides, it becomes a conversation of, you know, how much of a suspicion do you have that this could be infectious? I think if it's low enough and the initial testing, you know, all these patients should get at least one spinal tap, at least one lumbar puncture to look for signs of infection. And if they don't have a markedly elevated white blood cell count, if they don't have a lot of red blood cells that would make you think herpes simplex, for example, and their initial infectious workup comes back negative, we would think about starting them on immunotherapy, especially for those patients who, again, are continuing to seize despite everything we've done so far. So I think that's generally our practice is depends on your level of suspicion, but if your suspicion for an inflammatory or autoimmune process is high, we would not wait for diagnostic testing to come back, so the antibodies.
And to follow up on that a little bit more, once you've begun immunotherapy, what's the decision making or what's the timeline on when to stop immunotherapy? Do you do it 6 months, a year, 2 years? What's been sort of the practice or lessons that you guys have learned from this study or from your experience?
So I think it's very variable depending on the case. We've had some patients, for example, who come in refractory status epilepticus. We give them steroids, the seizures break, and then at that point, we kind of leave it at that. They're now controlled, they're doing better. That's not the typical case. I would say more often we would start these patients on immunotherapy. They continue to have a long hospital course. We ramp up the immunotherapy, so not just steroids. Maybe we do IVIG or plasmapheresis or even escalate to rituximab. In those cases, I think we're a lot more hesitant to peel it off because we do think it's contributing to why the patient is improving. So it depends a lot. And what we've found to be the most beneficial thing is to get these patients looped in with our neuroimmunology division early, making sure that sometimes they'll see these patients in the hospital, even do an inpatient consult on them. And other times we'll make sure that very shortly after discharge, they get plugged into that clinic. And that's because, you know, that clinic understands these conditions. They know the difference between different autoimmune conditions. And they work together with the epileptologist, which these patients will often require because they tend to continue to have seizures even after the status is controlled. And you have this good multidisciplinary group making that decision based on the specific patient's information. So it can be anywhere from one dose and stop, years and years, maybe indefinite. It's very variable, but I think having a good multidisciplinary team is really important.
And before we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit more about the conversations with patients' families. And I think it's important to walk away from this interview emphasizing that a lot of these patients can have good functional outcomes, and you did touch on that. Considering what you learned by looking at these cases, how would you counsel the family of a patient in super refractory new onset status, say for 10 days without a discovered etiology yet? Is there a point either in time or based on other clinical criteria at which your conversations start to recommend more palliative options and move away from therapeutic interventions?
So yeah, we want to be realistic with these families of patients with NORS in that this is a very severe condition. Not everyone survives, not everyone does well, but at the same time, many of our patients can do well. And especially if you look at our patient population, many of these are young, previously healthy people in their 20s, 30s with no underlying conditions. And so we've become very aggressive with how we treat these patients. And we know that someone can be in refractory status epilepticus for days and days and recover and do well. And so I think the way we have conversations with families is we balance that out as we tell them. You know, we want them to understand that this is very severe. Their loved one is very, very ill, but that there's reason to be hopeful that they can get through it and do well. And I would say that we have that conversation even when someone's been seizing for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, because we know that they can go that long and still recover. I think we start to think about palliative care when someone is accumulating so many complications. So they're having, you know, progressive infections they don't recover from. The seizures are, you know, coming back even on high doses of drips. They're becoming hypotensive. They might have a cardiac arrest. Events like that are when we start to think that somebody may not have as good of a chance of recovering. But I would say short of significant systemic complications like that, just because of the seizures is not a reason that these patients should not continue to get aggressive care. That's our practice, is to push really hard.
Understood. And I hope this has been really informative for our listeners. I hope everyone's keeping their guard up in terms of diagnosing these cases. And I think this has been informative in terms of helping guide workup and guide the conversations that we're having with families of these patients. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Matthews from Columbia University about her paper titled New Onset Super Refractory Status Epilepticus, a Case Series of 26 Patients. As always, please check out this week's issue of Neurology to read the paper and learn more. Elizabeth, thank you again for joining us on the Neurology Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, it's Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and I'm talking today with Matt Futterman. He's a sports writer for the New York Times. And we're discussing his recent article in the New York Times titled, Sledhead, Sledding Athletes Are Taking Their Lives. Did brain-rattling rides and high-speed crashes damage their brains? It was published on July 26th. Matt, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate your attention to this.
Over the past year or two, we've had several podcasts on traumatic brain injury and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. For our audience, you can check out some of those in the delayed recall episode that aired back on February 1st. But, you know, the athletes that we've covered in most of those include American football players and also some MMA fighters and boxers. So, Matt, when I read your article, this was the first time I'd ever thought about the potential that sports like bobsledding and skeleton pose to those athletes. And so I guess my first question for you is, what is sledhead?
Well, it's funny. It's a term that sliding sports athletes sort of have been throwing around casually for years in the same way that football players used to throw around, you know, I got my bell rung. I mean, at the heart of it, sledhead is basically a concussion, or at least it's all the concussion-like symptoms. You take what can be a very normal routine run in a bobsled or a skeleton sled, which is really the rails of a bobsled without the car attached to it, for those people who are not familiar with skeleton, and you go down head first and you go very fast and it's pretty scary. So you go down on what can be sort of a routine run, and when you're done, you are in a kind of mental fog, and you might be a little dizzy, and you just feel like your head has been put through a bit of a blender. I can recall having that exact feeling in 2013, the only time in my life I've ever been on a bobsled. I went halfway down the track in Park City. I did it in September, so we were on wheels and not on ice, so we weren't going nearly as fast as the people you see in the Olympics go. And when that run was over, I swore I was never going to do this again in my life because I just felt so awful. I mean, I could barely walk. It was about 10 or 20 minutes before I sort of felt normalish again. And I sort of put it out of my mind, and I didn't really think about it until someone mentioned to me in the wake of Pavle Jovanovic's suicide that there was a little concern that it might have had to do with brain injury.
So, Matt, what did you find out when you started looking into these sledding athletes and what's happened to them in recent years? What's the story?
You know, usually when you go out and report a story like this, there's some sort of small minority of people who are affected by the things you're looking for. And you sort of asking questions, you know, have you had any experience with this? Do you feel anything like this? This was like a nearly 100% hit rate. It was every person who has ridden in a bobsled or been on a skeleton, and even some losers say, oh yeah, I felt that. And yeah, I have some weird lingering effects from it. Whether it was, you know, for the mild cases, it might be headaches. For others, it might be, you know, a little problem with some memory issues that they think might be related to it. And then the people on the far end are essentially suffering from what neurologists seem to think is early Parkinson's. And their sort of guess is that it has to do with years of mild traumatic brain injury.
So do you know if any of these athletes that you report on, had any of them experienced head trauma from other sports or activities prior to sledding? I guess my question is it possible that maybe this is like a cumulative dose effect almost, that maybe a lifetime of contact sports and concussions has some kind of compounding effect?
So I think that is possible, that the experience of doing these sports may have exacerbated other problems. But how do you explain the women of the Canadian skeleton team who trained very, very hard for the Vancouver Olympics, sometimes taking as many as 12 runs a day, and were just wrecked in the wake of those games, and to this day are really, really suffering from the issues associated with this? And those women did not play football growing up. A lot of them didn't play hockey. And, you know, this was the sport that they did. So they're a bit of a control. But, you know, look, one of the things that's really hard is you're never going to know something like this for sure unless you do some kind of long-term longitudinal study. And that's kind of impossible to do because everybody's going to come at this from a different standpoint.
You know, Matt, when I read your article, one of the things that surprised me was just how strong the G-forces are that these sledding athletes experience. And you wrote in the article that they can move down the track at 70 or 80 miles an hour with gravitational forces 5 to 10 times normal. And so one of the questions I have is, and you've alluded to this already, but I think we all appreciate the risk associated with frank concussion, say, you know, when a football player is just blindsided in the open field and goes down, or a boxer takes a solid punch to the head and goes down. But obviously these sledders are at risk of crashing, and certainly that could cause trauma. But what about just like uneventful runs down a course? In other words, do these speeds and G-forces, even absent a crash, still put these athletes at risk?
Yeah, I think that's the thing that's the real concern here, because when you have a big crash, it gets treated and people see that and you stay out of the sport for, you know, weeks or months until you feel normal again. But just as you find with football players, where it's not so much the horrific open field blindside hit that a wide receiver experiences, although that's plenty damaging. But what they also find is that it's the repetitive banging, those subconcussive hits that build up over the years. You know, you've heard football players, especially linemen, describe it as, you know, line up in front of a wall and just run into the wall 40 times a day. And that's essentially what football practice is. The corollary to that in the sliding sports are these vibrations and these G-forces that they experience. And look, I'm not a neurologist. I'm not a brain expert. But the brain experts who have studied this compare it to shaken baby syndrome. And it's sort of like taking the head of an adult and just, in the words of the British neuropsychologist who I was speaking with who has studied this, said, you know, just giving it a really, really good shake. He was being a little facetious, but he was also sort of underemphasizing exactly what goes on.
In your article, you tell the story of many of the athletes in this sport, and of those who have passed away that you discussed, have any of them had autopsies to indeed look for pathological findings of chronic traumatic encephalopathy?
Yeah, I mean, several of them have. And so far, they've come back negative for CTE, but it's clear that there was other damage to the brain. There's sort of evidence of micro tearing and damage to the white matter. So I think, as it's been explained to me, just because you don't have CTE doesn't mean you didn't have some serious damage. And that, in fact, the people at BU, at least, you know, in retrospect, they're a little worried that they overemphasize CTE, because now people seem to look at it, oh, well, if you didn't have CTE, then it couldn't have been traumatic brain injuries that causes death. And their sense is, no, that's actually not true. It's just that the images were so dramatic and it was so easy to show people what it was that they sort of took advantage of that. And one of the unintended consequences of that is people seem to be not quite understanding that there are other kinds of long-term damage that you can experience from these traumatic brain injuries over time.
And I'd like to read a line from an article. You said, quote, "The question no one can answer, because accumulated brain injury is so hard to measure in real time, is how much is too much?" And so, you know, as neurologists, we're often asked this question about where to draw the line for athletes. And so I guess I'm just curious if you learned anything about the athlete's duration of exposure to these sports that seem contributory.
I'd have to say that it was pretty varied. You know, a guy like Travis Bell didn't do it for very long, but he had a horrendous crash that he never really recovered from. Then again, there's a guy like Steve Holcomb who did it for nearly 20 years. Didn't have that many bad crashes. He was a terrific driver, but there's no question that he was pretty concerned at the time of his death, which I think is still under investigation as, you know, either an accidental overdose or some kind of suicide. He certainly had suicidal thoughts. He was pretty upfront about that. You know, he had done it for a long time, and you have a lot of variation. Certainly, the longer these people did it, the greater the chances that they were going to have lingering effects from it. But just because people didn't do it very long didn't mean it was okay. If somebody didn't do this very long but had lots of really bad crashes and injuries that they came back from very quickly, which we now know is a really, really bad and dumb thing to do, that was a real problem.
You know, as we wrap up here, Matt, I acknowledge that this decision about contact sports, it's a personal one and something that each family really has to decide for themselves. And it's something that my wife and I have already discussed for our little 9-month-old son. But I'm curious if you have children and whether reporting on this has influenced what activities you would or would not let them participate in, or even you yourself would or would not participate in.
Yeah, I have 3 kids. I have a rising freshman in high school, a senior in college, and a sophomore in college. They're all girls. They've all played a lot of soccer growing up. I never really thought to limit how much they were going to play soccer. So I think it was a little less of a concern with girls, although there are a lot of girls who get concussions playing soccer. There's no doubt about that. And you monitor it. You know, in terms of my own activity, I'm a skier and, you know, there's no slope that I don't like look at and want to go down and want to go down it fast. And, you know, that's a little weird because it is risky and I'm a pretty risk averse person, but, you know, I'm well aware of the draw of some of these activities and that these are things that we like to do, we want to do. And I think it's really hard. I'm also a big long distance runner and it's unclear, you know, if that's going to be bad for me. And people ask me, oh, you worry about your knees? Do you worry about some of these studies that show that long distance running over long periods of time can build up a certain kind of plaque and cause arteriosclerosis? My friend, Amby Burfoot, who won the Boston Marathon way back in 1968, he has a great line, which is, I run to add life to my years, not years to my life. And I think of that line a lot when I think about things that I decide to do and that I don't want to do. You know, I don't think we can wrap ourselves in bubble. I do worry about, you know, the elimination of football because it's one of the few activities that boys who are, let's say, husky are actually encouraged to do. And if they didn't have football, like, would they just sit on the couch? And how dangerous would that be in terms of other diseases? So it's a real balancing act. These are not easy questions. I wear a helmet when I ski and I hope for the best. And I don't think I'd let my kids play football. I would discourage that in a big way. But other than that, I'm not really sure.
Well, man, I think this is a really timely article and something that we as neurologists are increasingly being asked about in terms of parents trying to make decisions about their children. I really encourage our audience to check out the article. Again, it was published on July 26th, the New York Times. It's titled, Sledhead, Sledding Athletes Are Taking Their Lives. Did Brain-Rattling Rides and High-Speed Crashes Damage Their Brains? Matt, thank you for joining us today and for your reporting.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And thanks for all the work you do.
Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on equity, diversity and inclusion, global neurology, and innovations in care delivery. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.